listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams so you can easily get to a healthy weight and get on with your life, because that is what it is all about. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. How amazing would that be? Sounds amazing, right? It is totally doable. If you would like to call me today and talk about what's going on with you, the number here in the studio is 818-570-5085. I'm in the new video studio, so I don't have that memorized yet. 818-570-5085. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is weighing on you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, and any kind of compulsive or emotional eating is not food. The problem with this kind of eating is not food. The real problem, it's what is eating at you. So please also feel free to call in anytime. Don't worry about interrupting me. I want to hear from you whenever you can call me. So today I'm going to talk about the most common eating disorder, the most prevalent eating disorder, the eating disorder that most people don't even know they have, and that is binge eating disorder. But first, a question from someone in my Facebook group. She says, I've realized something about my thinking, and I hope you can help me out. It has to do with people promoting body positivity, anti-diet messages, etc. Now, I'm familiar enough with you to know you do not have any bit of superiority or lack of understanding. However, at first glance at someone who's thin and in this movement, I think, yeah, easy for you to say. Easy for you to say that I just need to accept myself and that being thin isn't all it's cracked up to be. And yet, when I see someone heavier in this movement, I think, why should I listen to you? You're just giving yourself an excuse to stay fat. I've put people into a no-win situation, she says. She says, I know this probably has something to do with the thoughts I have about myself, like I want to lose weight, but then I'd become someone I'm now jealous of. Can you make sense of this? Well, yes, I think you are onto something. You're saying on some level, you're afraid to be the object of jealousy or envy. So you protect yourself from that by not losing weight. Unconsciously, of course, it's not like you're actively thinking, okay, I don't want to be the object of jealousy. I don't want people to dislike me or have an issue with me, so I'm going to keep myself from losing weight. No, that is not what you are thinking. You're thinking simply, I want to lose weight. But it's the unconscious, hidden motivations that have the most power over us. So there may be, as she was able to actually get to make conscious, I'm afraid I'd be someone I'm now jealous of, which means other people would be jealous of you. The other thing that strikes me about the question is the inherent mistrust. It's like she's saying that nobody could understand her. Nobody can help her. They say they can. They say they will. But there's no sense that they actually do get you or her, or they could just be there for her. So I'm wondering, to the person who wrote in this question, I'm wondering if that might strike a chord. If your expectations about people in the present or the future might be based on your experience of people in the past, who was it who couldn't understand you or help you? I'd be curious about that. So that's my food for thought regarding this question. And also, people ask me all the time about the body positivity movement. Is it reasonable? Is it okay? And I'm going to talk about this more on a future show because I really do want to get to binge eating disorder. But I think that self-acceptance is the key. I don't think it's necessarily healthy to be 200 pounds overweight and saying, hey, I'm body positive. There's very few people who are 200 pounds overweight are healthy. However, if you have a positive attitude towards yourself, that's ultimately going to help you lose weight. However, if you're saying, I weigh 200 pounds, I binge all the time, but hey, I accept myself, then there's some kind of disconnect there. Again, I'm going to get more into that. I know it's a very controversial topic. I'll get into that in another day. But okay, let's talk about binge eating disorder. Let's talk about BED, as it is called. Several years ago, I received an email from a new patient, and she was in treatment for binge eating. She was very attractive, very stylish, and at the time, her weight was normal, but she was binging like crazy. And this is what she wrote in the email. This is actually from my book, Food for Thought, Perspectives on Eating Disorders, is how I open the book. She wrote, "Just checking in. I want to write a list of what I ate at 4 p.m. A full-size candy bar, a gallon of ice cream, a small chocolate cake, yuck, a bowl of pasta and veggies with marinara and olive oil, a box of chocolate chip cookies. Earlier, I snuck food, 4 regular bars of Reese's peanut butter cups, 4 bagels, bowl of pasta, 3 glasses of OJ, a box of Wheat Thins, 1 bag of pretzels, lemon iced tea. Yes, I feel ill." So this is a binge, right? People sometimes tell me that they binged, and then they'll tell me they ate 5 cookies. No, that's not a binge. This is a binge. And I explained to Jane, this patient, not her real name, as I do with everyone, that whatever was going on with food probably seemed to her like the problem. But it was actually a solution to deeper hidden problems. Binging is a way of coping. It helps in some way. It distracts, it comforts, it numbs. It does something for you. It symbolically fills you up. There are so many ways that binging does something for you or expresses something. But of course, it also hurts you. And that is not just true for Jane. It's for everyone who struggles with binge eating. So what exactly is binge eating disorder? And by the way, if you don't want to call in, you can also post a question on my Facebook, either at Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin or at my private Facebook group, which you can join if you'd like. Just do a search for Dr. Nina's Food for Thought community and ask to join, and I will let you in. Someone will let you in, and you can write in with questions. Okay, I'm having trouble connecting to my Facebook group, so I will just continue. So binge eating disorder, known as BED for short, is the most common and prevalent eating disorder. It impacts as many as 8 million people in the United States alone and far more internationally. But many people with BED don't know they have a treatable condition. They think there's something wrong with them. They think it's about willpower. They think it's about control. And they are wrong. BED is defined as recurring episodes of eating significantly more food in a short period of time than most people would eat under similar circumstances, with episodes marked by feelings of lack of control. This happens an average of once a week over a period of at least 3 months. People who binge are often deeply ashamed of their behavior, and the resulting guilt, embarrassment, and disgust negatively impacts their self-esteem. They think the problem is what they're eating. They don't realize, as I often say, the real problem is what's eating at them. And there are many myths, assumptions, and misconceptions about binge eating disorder. One common assumption is that people who struggle with binge eating disorder are overweight, significantly overweight, or obese. Now, people with BED may be obese. They may also be a little overweight. They may also be within a normal weight range. Binge eating disorder is a complex psychological condition. People binge for many reasons, including denying, avoiding, or enacting painful or upsetting thoughts, emotions, or conflicts. Some people want to be thinner. For others, their weight serves a protective purpose. Some unconsciously fear thinness. They need to stay overweight for a variety of reasons, depending on, you know, what their conscious or unconscious conflicts are. Consciously, by the way, they may very much want to lose weight. Unconsciously, for example, they may fear being objectified, or they may worry they're going to lose some essential part of their identity by losing weight. Many people are afraid that once they reach their goal weight, they will discover to their dismay that they feel exactly the same. This is that illusion I talk about often. The idea that as long as there's an idea of who you're going to be when you lose weight, that fantasy person, that you that's going to exist when you lose weight is really compelling. But what if it doesn't happen? One patient said, as long as I have a hope that losing 20 pounds will make my life better, I have something to look forward to. I'm happy. But if I lose weight and my life doesn't get better, I will be crushed. It will be the end of hope. And more on that later. Also, the term overeating and binge eating are often used interchangeably, but there is a significant difference. Nearly everyone overeats at some time or another, since overeating basically refers to eating too much. And there are definitely different causes for overeating that generally have to do with food itself, not feelings, not conflict, not something internal. For example, many Americans, overeat on Thanksgiving when eating to excess is sort of celebrated and you're urged to eat too much. Other people don't eat enough during the day. This is very common. People will be like, I had a little bar or a shake or, you know, something, or I skipped breakfast. And then I had a little salad for lunch because I was being so good. And then when nighttime came, I ate the kitchen. Well, that is not necessarily only about psychology. That may be more about physiology. Because if you don't eat during the day, then you're going to be ravenously hungry at night, and your physiological need for food will lead to overeating, because when you're that hungry, you don't get full quickly enough. So what differentiates binging from overeating is the intensity and the scope of the binges themselves, which are usually, you know, not that great. They have a driven, compulsive quality. So there's the sense of you're doing something and you don't even fully enjoy it. And it's, or maybe you do enjoy it, but there's also this simultaneous shame and guilt and pain. And it's usually followed by remorse and self-recrimination. So when you overeat, you say, oh, wish I hadn't overeaten. I feel bad that I overate, but I'm just going to have less at my next meal or the next day. But the response to binging is, I can't believe I did that. I hate myself for doing it. I hate myself. It's shame. Guilt over overeating is, I wish I hadn't eaten so much. I regret that. Guilt, maybe. Shame is feeling bad about yourself for what you did. Another common misconception is that binge eating disorder is brain-based. As my patient Belinda put it, she said, I binge because I'm a food addict. Sugar is my personal crack. Now, Belinda was a stay-at-home mom with a lifelong history of weight problems. She began planning her meals the moment she woke up and remained preoccupied by food throughout the day. She obsessed about being good, as she put it, and not giving in to temptation. When she was not eating, she was thinking about the next meal. She felt as if she were in a love-hate relationship with food, particularly with sugar. She confessed that when she was baking cookies with her young daughter, she often sent the child out of the kitchen on some pretext so she could eat cookie dough alone. And she constantly fought the overwhelming compulsion to eat more cookie dough, and again referred to anything sugary as her own personal crack. She concocted elaborate excuses to explain the missing cookie dough, pretending to have dropped the mixing bowl or saying she accidentally used salt instead of sugar, so she had to throw it out, stuff like that. And later, again, she felt such intense remorse and self-loathing. Like Belinda, nearly everyone who comes to my office seeking treatment for binge eating or who wants to lose weight because they've tried every diet in the world and they can't, and they know there is a different way, there must be a different way. But nearly all of them are convinced that the problem is willpower. They're preoccupied with food, they can't stop thinking about what they're going to eat or what they're going to not eat, and they report that all their attempts to eat normally fail. they believe themselves to be addicted. Oh, here is a call. Hold that thought. Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina.
Oh, hello, Dr. Nina. Thank you for taking my call. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I was looking for some advice on how I could potentially do a little bit of a better job at my job.
Have you called me before?
No. My name's Murky. I'm the cold open guy with the Not Even a Show. I just need people to say, let's start the show.
Let's start the show.
Oh, you're the best, Dr. Nina. Thank you so much. You made this little boy happy.
Excellent. Have a great day. Hi, Dr. Nina. You're on. Hi, caller. You're on Dr. Nina's show. I just had a dyslexic moment. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Nina. It's Nicole. Good morning. How are you?
I think my last caller has called me before, and he's always trying to punk me, so I temporarily rattled me. So, hi, Nicole. How are you doing? Last time we spoke, you were in a really not good place. So tell me how you're doing today.
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm doing better. I mean, I think that was definitely a low, and I hadn't experienced something like that ever. I do feel like I'm recovering from that and just kind of looking at everything and just looking at myself. I'm trying to recover from it. And I don't know, something I've been experiencing for some reason more recently is I remember I kept telling myself, don't eat, don't eat, don't eat. And so that made me want to eat more. And so for some reason, I feel like I'm obsessing over food and my meals again. I don't know. I know something you might say is, well, if you weren't obsessing about food, what would you be obsessing about? What would you be thinking about, or what would you be concentrating on?
So it's like you're in my head. It's like you're in my head. Exactly. I was just thinking that. Yes. So it's a distraction.
I don't know. All of a sudden, I'm back there where I'm like, I keep telling myself, don't eat, don't eat, don't eat. So now all I'm thinking about is eating, 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 eating.
Right. Okay, so you're recognizing that the anticipation of deprivation, don't eat, is making you want to eat more or think about eating more or think about food more or think about all this stuff more. So you say all of a sudden, but I'm going to guess it's not all of a sudden. So if you seemingly all of a sudden backtrack or things are... You were progressing and then you regress. It's always for a reason. So let's discover what that reason is. Can you tell me around the time that you started having these thoughts?
Well, my boyfriend left for Miami, and then I was kind of by myself at his place, and I was feeling lonely. I don't know. I just started feeling anxious because, I'm living at home with my parents and I stay at my boyfriend sometimes, and I kind of just feel like this in-between place where, you know, I go to my boyfriend's and that feels like home, and then I go home and that feels like home. So I feel like I have two homes and I don't know where home is. And so I just feel like I'm kind of back and forth, and it's just giving me a little bit of anxiety and making me uneasy where, like, I just want to have one place that I call home and not going back and forth so much. So that's one thing.
That's significant, because if you don't feel settled, if you're either at your parents' home or at your boyfriend's home, and if you have no room of your own, like Virginia Woolf wrote a room of one's own, a room of her own, the importance of having space that is just yours is so important, because then you can you feel like you have a space that feels safe. Even if your boyfriend's house feels safe, it's not your space. So this can be unsettling, and you're in between. You're in limbo. You're neither here nor there. And if your coping mechanism traditionally was to turn against your body, to focus on food as a way to feeling like you had some control over your life or whatever, then you're turning back to this way of coping, but you just now we're getting to, well, what are you coping with? So this is one part of it. What else comes to mind?
Well, I'll tell you, but the other thing with that is, it's like, how do I fix that? It's like, okay, do I stay at my parents' house? Do I stay at his house? Or what I was thinking is to get my own place that's actually my place, but I don't know, I guess financially right now at this time, so I don't know if it's going to be temporary. Like, am I going to get into a 1-year lease? I think that's too long unless I find something that's like month to month. So
okay,
I don't know, should I just go to the next thing, or should we come up with a solution?
No, because here's the thing. There are two ways to deal with something. One is, what is the solution you're actually going to take? Are you going to get a place? Are you going to stay at your parents? Are you going to move in with your boyfriend? I guess those are the three choices. But because you can't make that choice right now, first I think you have to process, what does it mean and to be in this limbo? Does it remind you of anything, by the way? It doesn't have to. You know, it seems like on its own it's significant, but maybe it reminds you of another time in your life where you felt sort of betwixt and between. And what does it mean to you? What do you feel about it? Like to address the experience of it, not just resolve the problem.
Okay.
By taking action. But
what, say it again?
Not just resolve the problem by taking action. Like there are two things to do. One is to process what it all means and how it feels and what it's bringing up to you, because that's what's uncomfortable and that's what you're not able to be with, but you're getting to it now. And the other is, well, what do you do to resolve it? So those are two separate things. And by doing the first, which is working through all of the internal stuff, what does it mean, what does it feel like, what all of that, that can also help you come to a decision.
I guess one thing is, like, my ex-boyfriend at the end of our relationship, it's like, you know, we were kind of in limbo where at 6 months he's like kind of like was not he was scared of commitment, and he was kind of like in a place where he's like, let's go on a break for a week, let's see how this goes. And I feel like we were kind of in limbo, and at the end of the relationship it was just like a lot of anxiety and a lot of like limbo. I don't know, that's one time I can remember that I was in limbo, you know, with something.
Nicole, has it been about 6 months with this boyfriend?
No, it hasn't, but it feels like 6 months.
Okay.
It's been 3 months. Yeah.
But you're approaching, like, okay, so it feels like 6 months. It's 3 months. It sounds pretty committed. So it could, it might be less about the 6 months and more about the mistrust of relationship, because it's about trust, right? That can you trust and can you trust that the connection is solid, or is it going to fall apart? And remember, food represents in our psyche relationships with others. So if you're saying don't eat, I hear it as don't want, don't attach, don't let me feel safe by focusing on my body rather than focusing on my fears about attachment.
You like always hit the nail on the head. It's crazy. I think that's exactly what it is. It's like I felt like everything was going good with my ex-boyfriend, and then all of a sudden it was like, out of nowhere, like when I would least expect it, he's like, let's go on a break for a week. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, where is that from? Like, our relationship has been like 99% like positive, and that 1% that was negative for a moment, like, how could that be the deal breaker? So maybe I'm just afraid that, like, you know, if I'm imperfect, or like if something happens, then I'm just going to be like abandoned or left, or he's just going to like break up with me, or like be like, oh my God, you're not perfect, or like you did this, or you think this way, or you're that way. And he's just kind of like, be like, peace. I don't know.
And so your strategy for being perfect is to be the thinnest you can be. Let me tell you something about relationships. They're not based on perfection. You don't love someone because they're perfect. Do you think he's perfect? your boyfriend? Do you think he's perfect?
No.
Mm-mm. Makes life more interesting. I've never met a perfect person. He doesn't.
Yeah.
Real relationships are not based on these superficial qualities. Real relationships are based on truly having respect for the person you're with and just liking who they are, not just about what they look like.
Yeah, and I mean, like, he tells me stuff sometimes, and I'm like, wow. And, like, I don't know, I feel like I don't judge him for it, and if anything, it makes me, like, love and respect him more. But then when it comes to, like, opening up about something about me or myself, sometimes I freak out because I'm like, oh, if I tell him this, like, he's not going to love me. But, I mean, he tells me stuff, and it's, like, more extreme than anything. A lot of the stuff he says is, like, more extreme than anything I have or anything I experienced or anything I would say about myself. But I still, and I still love him, but I get scared to be like, okay, this is about me, you know, this is me, whatever.
I think,
I don't know.
I think this goes back to your childhood where you felt somehow that you know, with your mom's obsession with weight, and that you felt that you were less lovable if you were overweight, and that somehow you're more lovable for if you're a what you consider the right weight, and that there was not a message that who you are, the person you are. Yes, we need to be attracted to the people we're with. Otherwise, that's called friends. So, of course, there's an attraction. Yeah. There's got to be that attraction. But what keeps, that's enough to attract. That's not enough to have a relationship.
Yeah.
Relationships are based on who the person is, how they, you know, their values, their morals, how they are with others, how they are with you, the person that they are. And you did not get enough of a message that the person you are is what is lovable. You got a message that the way you look makes you lovable. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. You're right. I think you're 100% right. And also, what's funny is the other night we went to dinner with my parents. Me, my boyfriend, and my parents went to dinner. And at the dinner table, my mom said something like, I ate so much, I have to starve myself tomorrow. Like, tomorrow I'm going to not eat. Yeah. And my boyfriend picked up on it. Yeah, and the next day, I starved myself, and I was feeling really anxious, and I talked to my boyfriend about it, and he's like, you know, it's interesting that you starved yourself today, because you remember last night at dinner, your mom said, I ate so much, I'm going to starve myself. You did exactly that.
Your boyfriend is insightful. Like, he is insightful.
Yeah, yes. And I would have never... I mean, I wouldn't have seen that, and he saw it, and I was just so impressed. I was so impressed. He's done a lot of,
I think when you trust that he sees you, and he knows you, and it's not like you're keeping some, you're not the great and powerful Oz, making him think you're the great and powerful Oz, but really you're just the girl behind the curtain. That's how it almost sounds like. Like, if he really saw who you are, how you think, if you pulled back the curtain and shared yourself, that he's going to go, ew, I thought you were the great and powerful Oz. I'm going to guess he's not interested in the great and powerful Oz. He probably likes the girl behind the curtain and probably already sees you.
Yeah, and I feel like I have had, like, vulnerable moments or moments when, like, I've opened up or I've cried or, you know, I've talked about my anxiety. I talked about, like, you know, just, like, my thing with body, you know. And I don't know. He's made me feel, like, safe and beautiful. And he even said, oh, sorry, one second. There's someone behind me. He's even said something like, I think you're beautiful, and whether you're this or whether you're 4 inches bigger or 4 inches smaller, like, you know, you're beautiful. And, like, I don't know, he said those things to me and made me feel like safe and loved and all those things. So I don't know.
You have
I
to
feel like
trust his love. You have to trust him more.
Yeah.
You have attachment anxiety. You're not trusting the connection.
Yeah, I'm totally, I think I do have a trust thing going on because also, I don't know, when I was younger, my dad was in business with his family, and I feel like he gave so much and did so much, and then I feel like that his family kind of effed him over, and so that was like ultimate betrayal that I felt like my dad was betrayed by his own family at such a young age. I was like 10 or 11. And I feel like that just kind of like stuck with me, you know? And then I don't know, then I started dating, and my first boyfriend in high school, like my high school boyfriend, ended up being gay. So then that he told me he's gay like 4 years later. And like, that was another betrayal, you know?
Yeah.
Like it became so hard to trust people.
And so
I don't know, maybe
yeah,
that's the thing
that's
too.
The thing. So if you don't trust people, and your focus is not on your mistrust or your attachment fears, then what is a good way of distracting from these attachment fears and this mistrust? Focusing on every calorie and on your body and having a relationship with your body and food more than with a person. It thinking about it all the time, whether you're eating or not eating, whatever it is that's going on, it is a distraction from your vulnerability with other relationships.
100%. And I even feel like, okay, maybe when he was out of town and I was in his place by myself, it was kind of like, okay, I don't want to be needy. Like maybe, okay, maybe if I'm missing him, I shouldn't like call him or talk to him. I don't want to be like too needy or whatever. So like, I'll just focus on my relationship with food. Maybe that could have been, something.
Can I tell you a really quick story about that? When I met my husband, the and this was in 2002, and so the book The Rules had come out, so I read The Rules, and The Rules said never call a guy, don't show that you're interested, don't show that will put him off, that will turn him off. So they said just return calls or return emails or return texts or whatever. So I did exactly that. And I was crazy about my husband. Like the first date, I was just like, oh my God, I get it. This is a different level. What is happening? I was crazy about him, but I would not call him. I only called him back and we would have great conversations. But a few weeks in, he says to me, "So are you as into this as I am?" And I'm like, "Are you kidding me? Of course I am."
Are you kidding?
And he says, "Because like I've noticed," he tells me, you never call me. You're always returning my calls and it makes me feel like maybe you're not that interested as I am in you." And I took that rule book and I trashed it. I didn't even give it away. Nobody else needs to read these rules. These are bad rules, new rules. You know what? Showing your vulnerability shows trust, and it gives him an opportunity to be there for you the way you sound like you are for him. It allows him reciprocity. Yeah. Showing that you're interested in him is not going to make him go, "Ew, she likes me." Showing interest is going to make him feel good about himself. You like him. Challenge some of these notions and really, you know, as you call me, let's talk about this idea of trust. Because when you can trust in other people's love for you and you trust in your own lovability, food just becomes something enjoyable you have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, not a way of managing anxiety.
No, that makes sense, and I definitely want to explore that. But I do feel like, you know, there hasn't been games between us. He's been like very honest and open from the beginning about how he feels about me, and so it's made me feel comfortable to express and tell him how I feel about him. So that I think that's been good. And then I also just want to say, so last night, I don't know if I'm, I guess this has to do with food, but last night at the end of the night, we both kind of had a tough day, so we drank some wine, and then he made some ravioli, and I ended up not really wanting to eat the ravioli, because I was like, okay, well, first of all, I didn't want it, I didn't feel like it, and also, I was trying to eat healthy, like, low calorie, no carbs, whatever, and so I ended up...
Wait a minute.
Yeah, I know.
Where's my boo?
Yeah, I know.
This is my...
Okay.
Boo. Okay. Just had to throw that in there.
Okay. I know. And then so at the end of the night, I ended up having like three little chocolate peanut butter cup thingies. I think they were like, I think all three were 180 calories. And so I feel like I'm making up for it today. Like I had coffee and then I took my medication that takes away my appetite.
Nicole.
And now I'm trying like not to,
Nicole,
eat to make up for last night.
Your mother. You're your mother. You don't need to make up for something. You had 200 calories.
Yeah.
So what? This mentality, you're being your mother, and you're also, so there's a psychology, but there's an automatic learned way of relating to food that is your mother who says, dirt on my head, I should die because I ate that, or I need to starve myself tomorrow. This is something you have to challenge. This is not healthy. This is a diet mentality, and this keeps you thinking about food all the time, by the way.
And she also, like, she also, I remember she's like, oh, how do you think I keep my weight down? Like, yeah, I go to these parties, like, you know, let's say for 2 days I'm, like, at
Nicole,
all these parties and I'm eating and drinking, then I don't eat for 2 days and that's how I keep my physique.
Nicole,
yeah.
That is so unhealthy. It's a binge diet cycle.
I know,
cycle.
And that's why I'm
do
saying,
you,
I'm saying it.
Okay. We met at a party a year ago, right? I actually met you, right? You came up to me and said, oh my God, I think before you started calling me. So you've seen me in person, right?
Yeah.
Are you, and I, what I'm telling you, would you describe me as thin?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't do that. You do not have to do that. That is not the way of keeping thin. You do not have to do that. That is your mother's way, and it's toxic, and it keeps her feeling bad, and it keeps you feeling bad. So let's challenge that.
The thing is, also this trainer at Equinox who like teaches people keto and working out and stuff, he said if you cheat and you eat like pizza, let's say, you have to...
Okay, no. I'm not listening. Here, I'm not listening because trainers at Equinox are not registered dietitians. Trainers at Equinox,
I know,
unless they are a registered dietitian, what these people are doing are keeping this diet mentality in your head. Diet mentality leads to binging. These ideas are wrong. There is nothing wrong with eating pizza. There is nothing wrong with eating a couple of Reese's, chocolate thingies, whatever. If you have the attitude that that is forbidden and you can't have it, you're going to feel guilty. You're going to starve yourself. Then you're going to eat again. You're going to mess up your metabolism. You're going to have a good food, bad food mentality, which is going to translate into a good you, bad you mentality, which is going to be when you eat pizza, you're going to feel bad about yourself. No, this is what you have to consciously reject. So
I feel like I had made so much progress and I was working on all these things, and I don't know how I regressed so much. I don't know how
it's normal. And I think it has a lot to do with what we were talking about earlier. When you get super triggered, and this, you can regress. So there's something triggering. The main problem is not all this eating and pizza and whatever. The problem is trust, relationship trust. That's what you have to look at. So give it some thought. Call me next week and we'll keep talking about it.
Okay, thanks, doctor.
But don't listen to these trainers or your mother. They're not right. They're just keeping you in an old way of being, and that way is toxic.
Wait, Dr. Nina, I don't feel okay to hang up.
Okay.
Can I just stay on for a second?
Yes.
I just don't know what to do about this trust stuff. What do I do with that?
Separate the relationship you have from the relationships you had. So there's this what if, right? You're going, well, what if this guy, what if it happens with this guy too? What if you can't trust relationships? Look, my father's family betrayed him. My first boyfriend was gay. My other boyfriend broke up with me out of the blue. I've got a narrative that, you know, relationships can't last and you can't trust it. What if it happens again? So the antidote to what if is what is. I want you to write down everything you know to be true about your boyfriend's feelings towards you and his way of being in a relationship. I want you to write down everything that is reality, not a fear. How does that feel?
Okay, I love that.
Okay, good.
It feels good.
Good.
What is? Write down what is. Okay, thank you. I feel better.
Good. And keep feeling better. Okay. Talk to you later.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Yeah, if you're focused on food, if you're turning to food, even whether or through thoughts of food, it means you're turning away from something else. Okay. I am going to keep talking about binge eating disorder, and I'll probably have to continue next week. But basically, people who feel out of control with food think they lack willpower because they have a physical addiction to food. But is food addiction real? Now, there are studies that appear to make a case for the reward theory of food addiction, which correlates certain foods with increased dopamine levels in our brains. Dopamine is a chemical that mediates pleasure and motivation in our brains. Sugar, fat, and white flour indeed activate the release of dopamine. So, you eat these foods, you get a dopamine rush. I wonder if dopamine is why, it has to be why it's called dope with drugs. And you feel good. And so you want to keep eating in order to keep getting that dopamine release. And researchers point out similarities between food and other substances, including the fact that food shares common drug pathways in the brain. Some foods activate reward neurons and dopamine receptors, and the anticipation of eating also activates the same area in the brain as drugs do. Okay. Sounds reasonable, right? Sounds like a good case for sugar addiction. But here's the thing. Yes, sugar does indeed change the brain, as do certain drugs, but so does any activity involving pleasure. Sex, exercise, spending time with friends, anything that you're doing that's fun releases dopamine. Psychotherapy also changes the brain. It's been shown to be more effective than medication. Now, there are also many alternative ways to explain the neurobiological response to sugar and all foods. Food is meant to be rewarding. It's meant to be rewarding. That's why the reward centers of our brains light up, and that normal hunger actually increases neural activation. And there's also the impact of behavioral conditioning on eating. There are a couple of studies in which researchers asked people to eat their forbidden foods. Now, they thought they were going to make the case for food addiction because they anticipated that when people started eating their forbidden foods, they wouldn't be able to stop, thus making the case that, yes, indeed, food addiction is a real thing. However, what happened? What happened is because they were given permission to eat their forbidden foods, they actually ate less. And this is the opposite of what would be expected from a food addiction model. And this points out how important psychological factors are when it comes to behavior. Now, this may have little relevance to a person who feels like an addict. I've had patients say to me, hey, look, the science doesn't matter. Even if you tell me I am not technically a food addict, I still feel like I need a fix. But feelings are not facts. The deeper we dig below the surface, the more the roots of the compulsion to eat become apparent, the more you find out that your behavior serves a purpose. Just as Nicole realized
that all this hyper dieting and focusing on her food and weight and all of that was serving the purpose to distract her from her uneasiness and her fears about relationships, her attachment trauma, I guess I would call it. Because when you identify what the purpose of this eating or thinking about it or focusing on it, when you identify what that purpose is and you find new ways to respond to yourself and resolve those internal conflicts or express them, you stop binging. So in treatment, Belinda came to realize her obsession with food distracted her from deeper concerns. She had grown up in a very conservative religious community where it was not okay to question authority. And she learned to stifle her natural inquisitiveness and just do what was expected to her. She complied. She married within the community. She tried to get on with her life and make the best of it. But her life felt wrong. She told herself she was doing the right thing, but it didn't feel right. And she struggled with a profound restlessness and dissatisfaction. The only thing that comforted her was eating. Thinking about food and eating also distracted her from wishing for a more authentic life. If she was thinking about what she weighed and how much she was going to eat and this diet or that diet or whether she's going to work out and for how long and how many calories and blah, 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 you know how that goes, then she wasn't thinking about how inauthentic and dissatisfying her life was. So she did not have enough figurative sweetness in her life, and food was the primary means by which she was able to experience pleasure. If you don't have enough fun in your life, you can become overly reliant on food for fun. And then the more fun you do have, the less you're going to use food for fun. See how that works? Works both ways. So Belinda eventually got a job she enjoyed. She started taking pottery classes. She made some new friends outside of her religious community. And she found that she could bake cookies without binging on cookie dough. She ate cookies in moderation without the craving and guilt that had tortured her for so many years. And she said, how is this possible? A recovered alcoholic can't just have one drink, so how can I eat a couple of cookies and stop? The reason is we have brains, but we also have minds. So she did indeed have this rush when she ate cookie dough, biological response to sugar. But from a psychological perspective, she was distracting from her problems, displacing helplessness in her relationships onto helplessness over onto food. And that had to do with her mind. So when we examined that and changed that, everything changed. She was not physiologically addicted to the substance of food. She was using food to cope. So, you know, we can think about it as an eating addiction, if we're going to use the addiction word, an eating addiction as opposed to a food addiction. The behavior, not the substance of food. Bottom line, we are capable of learning new ways of relating and responding to ourselves and to other people. And when we identify and process our internal conflicts, when we create new ways of understanding and reacting to ourselves, to thoughts, to emotions, to situations, we change our relationship to ourselves and to food. So, that is the show for today. I'm going to keep talking about this. Again, if you have any questions, please feel free to drop a comment in the Facebook page or email me or anything. Thank you so much for joining me here on LA Talk Radio. I am here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific. You can listen live or you can listen later on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. See you next week.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.